Walter Bridenstine. I'm the CEO of Gas Techno Energy and Fuels, operating here up in North Dakota.
Now, when you say operating here up in North Dakota, where's a home base for you people?
I'm based in northern Michigan, a small town near Traverse City, Petoskey, some people may have heard of.
No kidding. Up in northern Michigan, huh? Here, I thought maybe you were from Texas or Louisiana or something like that. So you're based out of northern Michigan. You're up near Kenmare, up in the Bakken oil field. Are you in any other shale plays, or are you just up in the Bakken?
No, I moved up here in August last year with my tool trailer and camped out in a hotel for a while, and then we started to assemble the equipment, and now I live up here on the oil field site in a skid shack.
Those sound like the old days of the 2012 Bakken boom. So you're actually kind of doing the old school work and live right on the site and everything. So what is it that you have going up there near Kenmare?
Well, we were selected by an operator here to help manage their gas flaring problem. And so they took a number of wells. They had 9 wells that they tied together, small wells that are flaring individually at the well site. They tied them together with a pipeline distribution system, brought those to a central location near one of their saltwater disposal facilities. And we tied into that line, and now we gather the flare gas from those wells, and we process it on site by removing NGLs, natural gas liquids, from the flared associated gas. And we just in January moved our GTL plant up from Michigan, where we had it operating in a place called New Haven, Michigan, near Ithaca. And we've got it set up now to process not just NGLs, but also we'll make methanol from the associated gas.
So NGLs, is there a market for that currently? Is there a transportation that needs to be done, or are they just burning it right on site? I guess. Talk to me a little bit about after you get the NGL, what happens next?
Well, the market up here in North Dakota has been, from what I've learned since August, since working up here the last 6 months, is that NGLs are very common. They're produced by a lot of operators, One Oak, some of the midstream companies, and they transport those through large pipelines to Texas in Conway, and they separate those NGLs and fractionate them into methane, ethane, propane, butane, hexane, pentane, etc. And that's where that gives them access to, you know, international distribution markets, as well as into the Texas chemical industry. So NGLs are very common up here, but if you don't have a pipeline to your facility, to your well pad, then you either flare the gas or you wait patiently to tie into a pipeline. And if the pipeline is not full, if that distribution line is not full, then you can sell your gas via pipeline to these big midstream operators, and then they'll send them off to Texas. Some small fracs will actually process them, and of course One Oak does too. They'll separate them, they'll fractionate them here, and then sell the product locally, regionally, into the market, as LPG and so forth. But that That process to do that really requires a lot of pipeline infrastructure, and that's what has been the problem with some of the bottlenecks and why you see so much flaring going on, is that the pipelines are having a tough time to get to all these drilling sites and pads. So our technologies come along as a alternative to well site pipelines, and we can actually install, as others have done up here, very successfully. G2It comes to mind is another company that is up here, and they provide modular NGL systems, and they take the flared gas from the site, from the well site. They process it right there on site, make the NGLs, and then they truck the NGLs to these big midstream operators who buy them and fractionate them. So that it's been done up here very well, successfully, and the market's growing to look more toward on-site processing of the flared gas as opposed to pipeline delivery of the flared gas. And so that's where we come in. We do the same sort of thing as G2It and others. We actually have one further step beyond what G2It and others do. We actually provide also the GTL plant along with the NGL plant. So we've got a two-part solution, whereas most other companies have just the single part NGL solution.
For me, this has been a lot of fun watching the evolution of these natural gas projects and there's just that whole market because one of my, I don't know, first probably five stories, I think, was the next big boom is natural gas. And back then, back in 2011 and 12, the word science project and cost and that sort of thing was dominating the conversation. And so, you know, and in fact, you mentioned G2It. I go back that far with Brian Siebel, the CEO. I remember when he was just kind of first starting out in the Bakken, you know, they were doing these things, and he was one of the ones talking about being a science project for some different areas. And so the reason I asked you about, you know, the different transportation and that sort of thing is because I see the evolution happen, and I see where it's becoming more common now where outfits like yourself and you mentioned G2It, so I'll mention them too, are being used a lot more for on-site. And that, to me, is being validated by some of the things that you're talking about here. So is it the cost has got down? Is it just there's more familiarity with it? What's the reason behind more of this on-site NGL technology becoming a solution for these oil companies?
I think the big issue up here is that oil companies don't typically like to venture into new technologies. And so G2It has been the pioneer largely up here. Others have also come and gone, but G2It is a first-class operation, and they've been able to demonstrate successfully to a number of their clients and operators that they can do it. And so that's given positive feedback to the industry that, you know, processing on-site can be done. Preferably, all the oil companies would rather just sell pipeline gas. And it's simple. Once they tie in, they've got access to the pipeline. They don't have to worry about on-site processing and the additional equipment and the issues that go along with on-site processing. However, in the last, say, 12 months, as more drilling has come into play and the well pads are getting larger, you know, 3, 4, 5, 8, 10 wells per pad, as they look at these multiple well pads, you have a significant volume of associated gas that comes with the oil. and the pipelines are full. So even if you tie into a pipeline, the chance of being able to sell your gas through the pipeline is a challenge. And so these operators, even though they prefer to have pipeline access, because of the overwhelming volume of gas that's being put into these pipelines, you might find wells that actually, in certain areas in the reservation and so forth, they will sell gas 25% of the time and flare 75% of the time, even with pipeline access. So because the state is calling for $11 billion of new infrastructure development to meet the flaring restrictions in October, November, they're going to limit, they want to see 88% utilization of the gas as opposed to 85% utilization, which they have right now in place as a mandate. That becomes very, very difficult. That 3% really is going to be a challenge to meet. But the politicians and the environmentalists and the class action lawyers and everybody are watching, obviously, carefully to see that the state continues to try to come up with solutions. And so you see NDIC calling for investment into North Dakota, this $11 billion worth of investment. And we can be part of that solution. You know, you don't have to go big, giant anymore, so to speak. You know, we can go small and try. We're not going to make the same impact that they would on a large scale with the pipelines and the big gas plants and the distribution facilities, but we can make a positive impact by offering on-site processing, and you know that is starting to become an option more and more and more, because they have to meet these requirements. Unless the state reverses their stance on flaring and decide to not require 88% utilization this October, November, these oil companies are going to be faced with having to use us technology guys more and more. We're going to have more interest. And so I think the industry is being driven by flaring regulation. North Dakota is a leader in the world in requiring operators to utilize the gas. There is a significant amount of gas being flared in Texas, and they don't like to talk about it. I get emails from guys in Texas going, you would be surprised at how much flaring we're doing down here, and regulators are letting them get away with it. But Wyoming, Colorado, North Dakota, Montana have all taken a different approach. It is extremely difficult to go into these markets and just simply drill, produce oil, and flare gas. They're not letting it happen like they are in Texas. So we'll see what happens. Next week is a big meeting. I think it's next week or this week in Denver with the North Dakota Petroleum Council to talk about flaring issues and to see what they're going to do, and we'll see what NDIC does. But we have the other thing, the second thing I think, besides regulatory issues, is that we know now from working up here that gas sold through pipeline on an equivalent basis, this is sort of associated gas, can fetch prices of about $9 to $12 per barrel equivalent if you were to convert that gas into barrel equivalent pricing. So a $9 to $12 per barrel equivalent for associated gas is pretty typical up here. And then if you were to take and fractionate that gas into its individual components down in Texas, you would look at market pricing of the gas. This is not assuming any cost to get it there, but just market pricing of about $36 per barrel. In our case, with Gas Techno and our process, we have a dual process that makes NGLs and the GTLs. If you were to price those in the market here in North Dakota, the liquids, you'd end up with about $71 a barrel up to $80 a barrel. And that's pretty significant if you think, you know, about an operator who's excited about black gold and crude oil at $60 a barrel, but yet they're flaring the gas, which, you know, could be worth $80 a barrel. Why on earth would you not consider using us on site if you can get good value? So landowners, royalty owners, the government, you know, should really take a closer look at the value we can provide to the market, and you know, open some doors for us to expand up here in North Dakota.
I just got off the phone with Senate Majority Leader Rich Wardner for about a half hour, and he mentioned several times during our discussion the pipelines were stressed out, and with all the investment going into infrastructure, there's going to need some new pipelines with the new addition of the plants, you know, the One Oak plant that got proposed, and Targa and Hess, and then of course you've got a few other of these gas gathering plants that they keep talking about. But when the pipelines aren't there, that's going to, you know, I mean, you can't have the chicken before the egg is what I'm getting at here. So I do see where companies like yours are not only going to have an opportunity increase, but I'm starting to see where the state almost, you know, you're talking about regulations and that sort of thing. Are there any conversations of the state doing any subsidies to these energy companies so they can bring more business to companies like yourself to solve this problem? I mean, they do it in so many other areas. So why is that conversation even being had, or am I just crazy?
There is some, we actually learned of a program that the state, I think the NDIC kind of started the process several years ago to allow companies like ourselves or operators, if we could install equipment on site to process the flared gas on a project by project basis, the state would exempt you from sales and use taxes. So when I first came up here in August, we started looking at ways in which we could help support the costs. Because I was putting in, you know, about $200,000 worth of infrastructure, equipment, expenses, and as a small business, that was the challenge for us. And so we learned of this program, and we applied to the state to be exempt from sales and use taxes on buying local equipment, and They approved us, so we've got an exemption for this site where I'm at today, and so we've submitted our receipts and all that stuff to the state, and they've given us a refund check on the local state sales taxes that we paid on equipment, and so that was a small incentive. It was helpful. It's kind of, it can be laborious to do all that paperwork for, you know, $4,000 or $3,000 in savings, but it was a good chance for us to use the exemption, and it helps us too with a little bit of credibility when we say we're, you know, tax exempt in this project. But we're looking at going to the reservation next on a project that we think we may have won the bid on. And that, you know, I don't know the reservation rules, but they can be pretty laborious, I'm told. And we've met with a couple people, and we realized that it's a totally different scenario there to figure out where there might be incentives from either the tribe or what possibilities exist there. But beyond that, the state, we've applied for a couple grants. We were approved on one grant by the state, which we didn't meet the deadline to take the funding because we were building the plant in Michigan at the time. And so we applied for another grant last year, and they called us and said that we were not selected. So I think it's going to be tough to get more support for these new technologies at the state level. But I think it's all going to depend on what happens with this meeting next week in Denver, and how they recommend what to do. Are they going to, you know, encourage new technologies to work at site? Are they going to discourage us? Will they encourage operators to consider on-site technologies, or will they discourage them and focus on pipeline only solutions, you know, in this $11 billion worth of infrastructure? You know, NDIC is the leader. Everybody looks to them and their voice. So if it's either encouraging or discouraging, we just have to wait and see.
I guess I don't see that many options, to be perfectly honest. I mean, there's a certain law that's in place that you have to have a certain percentage of gas flared. And if the pipelines are full, I guess, to me, I just don't see a lot of options is where I'm getting at. So I'm looking at it where they would only encourage your types of gas gathering at the very least as a Band-Aid until some of these other major plants come on board. Because when the next phase comes on board, it's going to be a whole new ball game in the Bakken, and we all know that. But until then, there's some things, some bridges that need to be done. And quite honestly, there is quite a few wells on the books that they haven't drilled yet because they're still trying to find the workforce to go out and do it, but doesn't mean that they don't have the you know, maybe the finances secured. They just got to go ahead and implement it now. So do you know what I'm talking about, to where I don't see them having a lot of options? So I know what you're trying to say, that, you know, the meeting could go a lot of different directions, but I guess I'm looking at it where it could only go a couple.
Yeah. And no, I agree with you totally. I mean, I think that there's a genuine interest, obviously, that oil, nobody wants to just waste the gas resources. That's just, you know, human nature. I mean, there's a lot of putting all that money up into the air, and you know, you avoid the royalty owners. They need to be paid for that. The state needs to get their severance taxes. And the oil companies, obviously, it's a way for them to get a return on their investment. So wasting the gas is a non-starter. North Dakota's taken the lead, you know, really, if you look, I've worked around the world in their regulatory framework to say, we definitely want you to stop flaring. We're at 85% now. They have recently been putting more pressure on operators to not just extend their drilling program unless they deal with the flaring issue. So that pressure is starting to mount. The big issue will be this 88%, because if they do approve the 88% and they leave it alone, that's going to put huge pressure on the operators in the state, because now they're going to be out of compliance starting from November, just by the nature of the current production. And it'll put huge pressure on the state and industry to solve the problem. And I think you're 100% right. At that point, when there's that much pressure, we will definitely have a seat at the table. There's no doubt about it. I've reached out to try to be, you know, part of this meeting in Denver and haven't had any feedback. So we'll just have to, I just have to be patient and wait and see how things go. If they don't go to from 85 to 88, if they choose to grant an extension, then we just have to be patient and keep promoting new technologies as a well site solution. And I think at some point, some of the operators will see the value. As I mentioned before, why sell gas for $12 a barrel if you can convert it on site and make $70 a barrel? Those are economics that are attractive to operators, and I think that over time they'll start to see that we can compete with pipelines and give them an alternative.
Well, there's many people from John Gibson, former CEO of One Oak, to Harold Hamm from Continental Resources, to Lauren Scott, who's an energy expert economist, who've flat out said, you know, revolution changes and rewriting business plans. And so I think what's happening is, you know, there's a rewriting happening of an industry, starting with the kings, which is the oil and gas companies, and it's trickling down. And so the technology portion, the new workforce, if you will, all these different things, you know, this is new to people. You know, we kind of joke that the old days of slinging chains, those are kind of gone, and the nomadic workers, those are kind of gone now. It's more of, you know, there's a little more white in the collar these days, and there's, you know, there's more precision in terms of big data and technology, and, you know, there's becoming hubs, and, you know, the hitches are getting redefined too. And so I look at kind of what you're going through right now, and, you know, it's almost like a slow and steady will win the race type of a thing, you know?
Yeah. Well, we've been in development for 15 years, and, you know, it's been a challenge. I built, in 2010, I built my first little pilot plant in my garage in northern Michigan. And, you know, along with that came a couple, you know, small explosions that the neighbors thought I was shooting guns off in the garage, but that wasn't the case. I was just not sure how the reaction was gonna work. So, we've paid our dues from, you know, right from the garage in 2010. We did a very successful test in 2011 on an oil field with that same pilot. Then we built a prototype / demonstration plant that was in a 25-foot car hauling trailer. We hauled it to an oil field in Kalkaska, Michigan, and set it up on an oil field there and got it working successfully with what I call second-generation technology. And then this third plant we built in 15 and 16 and then moved it into operations in the center part of Michigan in 2017, and operated that, in 2016 in July, and then operated that up till July of 2017. And that's when I moved out here, because we had such success. The decision was, okay, jump in the truck, grab the tool, come out to North Dakota, just live on site. And I've been here 6 months, and I've only been home twice now. Each for a week at a time in the last 6 months. So I'm committed to prove that we can do it. So I'm excited to see what happens with, the continued oil price and operators continuing to drill up here. So we'll at some point get our name out there, name recognition, and I think we'll be able to, come up with some customers.
Walter Bridenstine, CEO, Gas Techno Energy, and we're talking a little bit about not the early days, folks, the current days of the Bakken oil boom right now. And I was chuckling because in my early days, I was in a food truck. I actually bought a food truck sight unseen off Craigslist, drove it out to the Bakken and set up a food truck. And that's where I did my radio show from the early days. And I chuckled because I was the only radio show out in the Bakken at that time, live and, you know, and tackling local issues and all that other stuff. And I laughed so hard because Senator Mike Enzi was out in the Bakken. At the time, Congressman Rick Berg was parading through a lot of senators and congressmen. And Mike Enzi from Wyoming was there. And I laugh because here he is on my radio program in front of this just awful-looking, terrible food truck dive of a thing. And it's just, and you know, but you know, hearing your story out there, you know, I mean, it's those types of things that really make you appreciate the oil and gas industry, because it's such a work hard, play hard industry, and there's so much economic opportunity and so much intellectual opportunity that's happening right now. So anyway, you got me reminiscing in my head a little bit there, but I you know, in fact, there wasn't even Wi-Fi out there at that time, so we had to call an audible, and we joked that the social media was our food truck.
Exactly. People that came up and listened.
That's all we had. So anyway, but you mentioned the reservation earlier, and we do quite a bit with David Williams and Ken Hall and a number of different people with the MHA Nation, Missouri River Resources, and kind of their energy empowerment quest they have going on out there. You know, about 20% of the Bakken reserves are under native land. And as they've so articulately have said to me in the past, the average North Dakota lease privately takes about 3 days. Well, they've got a 49-step process, not days, but process. So sometimes it would take 9 months to a year before they could get anything going. And, you know, their argument early on was that put them at a disadvantage because everybody had a 3-day, had, you know, they can go in 3 days. Well, these guys are still doing paperwork and everything else like that. So you've mentioned about a little bit about the reservation. So talk to me about that integration in your mind or in that whole process, how you see that, because it's a totally different world out there.
Well, I'm new to it. I've only been out there several times and saw the flares and have met with some folks out there. And what I have learned is that there is a tier one, tier two, tier three structure where, you know, if you want to do business on the reservation, you've got to contact some of these companies that are approved and then work through them to do your business. And so we've just started to reach out to some of these companies. Next week, I'm hoping to be introduced to one of the tier one operators out there to see what their interest might be in helping us to operate on the reservation. So I'm kind of new at it, but we did have a couple of the employees from MHA Nation come out and visit with us back in, I think it was October, November, when we were first set up and operating here. And it was interesting because they were talking about their, you know, the plans for this Missouri River company that they had set up to do expansion and more drilling and be, you know, more of a tribal-based operating an oil company. And so at that point, we were thinking that would be a, you know, because they, just by the nature of their culture, they take flaring very serious. You know, they don't want to waste that resource. So they're probably one of the bigger promoters that we would find on the reservation to help alleviate some of the flaring. And so we'll have to wait to see if we can get into the network there and find out who would be supportive of what we're doing. And so we're looking forward to that. But I will just say one thing is that I'm from Northern Michigan, so I grew up you know, with significant snowfall coming off Lake Michigan. So for me to see, you know, 2-3 feet of snow in a night when you wake up in the morning and cold weather is not uncommon. But when I came out here, and it, being it's more flat, I've never really had to deal with minus 20 to minus 40 degree temperatures day after day, night after night, and trying to run a processing plant out here. It's been quite an experience. We've had about a 95% uptime in operations, but there's been times where it was so cold, everything froze shut, and I mean, I've got heat trace, and I use methanol, and I've got everything insulated like we would do in Michigan. So I've had that experience, but it was unique to be on a man lift 25 feet in the air trying to replace a valve in minus 40, you know, temperatures, going, wow, I'm good for 5 minutes. I got to get down and go into the compressor room and put my hands and face against the heater, because it was, wow, crazy. So I'm happy that we've been through this, and I'm hoping that March will be a little kinder to us, and you know, start to go into spring so that we can start to look for new locations. And I'd certainly love to somehow get onto the reservation and find some possibilities.
I chuckle. I remember back, I think it was 2014, it was the sixth coldest winter on record in North Dakota, and I think it was like 63 consecutive days below zero, something like that. Diesels were gelling up on the interstate, et cetera, et cetera. And I just remember that being miserable. And I grew up in North Dakota, and so I was used to that cold and et cetera. But I just remember that winter, it was so miserable. And then a buddy of mine calls me, and it was one of the first days it was like above 10 degrees, I think. And he calls and he says, "Hey, it's really nice out today. Let's go ice fishing." And I took a step back and I thought, okay, if it's nice enough to go stand on a frozen lake, I got to rethink my living priorities.
Yes, exactly. I'm just fortunate that I've, you know, had the cold weather experience in northern Michigan, because the other colleague that's working with me out here, he's from Canada, so he's used to it as well. But I know some of the guys that are coming in from some of the southern states and so forth, yeah, their body's just not used to it. Just like if I had to go to Texas and work in 90-degree heat, I would, you know, melt, and he'd have to sweep me up. It's way too hot for me. So, but yeah, it's going to be an interesting challenge up here, I think, to, you know, operate different projects, different sites, you know, knowing that you've got to prepare for the winters up here. It was a good experience for us to go through it, because, you know, this was our first project up here, and I know now what not to do, what to do. So the next project we move to, I think we're going to be that much better, and I won't necessarily have to live in a skid shack on the site running it 24/7.
All right, Walter Breidenstein with CEO of Gas Techno Energy, and kind of wrapping up here a little bit, anything that we missed out on, anything you want to reiterate that kind of give you the final word, if you will? You know, I mean, I kind of, you know, I'd say use it as a good opportunity, say treat me as if I'm a potential customer, let people know how they can get in touch with you, why they should use your services, and, you know, at the same time, you're going to let people know how you're solving the problem of flaring out there. So it's kind of a 3-for-1 for the listener and the CEOs and everything else out there. So go ahead.
Well, first of all, I want to thank you for this opportunity. It was interesting to see your website and videos and some of the stuff that you've been putting online. I mean, it's really exactly what the type of forum that I would, you know, that I was very happy to be part of. In terms of the technology, I would say don't let the issue of new technology scare you away. It's new, but it's not unproven, and we've been working at it for 15 years. It's been a long, hard struggle, but we've got now good third-party validation in operations in Michigan. We're up here now to stay in North Dakota. This is going to be the focus for me over the next couple of years to really address the flaring problem. I think the state, as long as we can get some support from, we don't necessarily need to have their funding, because I know that can be difficult, but if we could at least know that we're part of the solution, and the large-scale pipeline infrastructure and large-scale project development is not the only promoted solution to the problem up here. If we can be part of the small solution where well site technologies are also at the table, I think there's a good chance that we will be able to demonstrate our commitment to North Dakota. It'll only bring value to the state for revenue. It'll also bring value to the reservation, where anybody that drives through there knows it is significant, the amount of flaring that's going on. And the pipelines are full. Putting in new pipelines is going to be a challenge, I'm told, up there. It's not a simple process. We could be, as you mentioned earlier, a temporary solution. So we could go in there, set up, and at least provide temporary relief to the flaring. And then once they do connect to a pipeline and they do get, you know, continuous 24/7 capacity flow, then we can pull our equipment off and go to the next site. If those options for a pipeline are not going to be available, it'd be great for us to be out there for a couple years out of sight, because that helps us to try to recover our cost over 2 years. I know a lot of the operators that we've talked to, their position is, well, we only want you out there for 6 months. And it's hard to do financing. You know, I've talked to banks. I just went to Williston a couple days ago and met with one of the bankers, and, you know, trying to ask for money when you've got an operator who's a first-class, you know, global name saying they only want to pay for 6 months, you know, on a $2 million piece of equipment. You know, banks are looking at you going, are you sure they won't go a year? And I'm like, they're only saying 6 months, and it makes it hard. So it's hard to come up with all of the answers, you know, right now for how to solve this problem. But I think if we could inspire some of the CEOs and some of the leadership in North Dakota to look at new technology solutions at the well site, there's no doubt we can be part of the solution. And I think also the World Bank and GGFR and some of the global environmental organizations and so forth that are looking hard at North Dakota as a contributor to emissions. If they see that we're taking a leadership role in solutions, that'll also look good for the state. So we can make some friends in those circles as well. So that should be about it for now.